The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Tuesday. And we have an excellent program tonight, as we always try to present for you. Wherever you are, hope you had a good day today. The world is not getting any better, although there are exceptions here and there, but you've got to look for them because they come and go very quickly. Our first guest tonight is new to the program. He has an extraordinary mind. He has developed that mind by researching many of the things we spend so much time on here and have for 24 years. Next month, in June. Hard to believe, but it's true. Herbert Dorsey, D-O-R-S-E-Y, is standing by from his home in Hawaii. Hopefully he's sitting, not standing. Are you there, Herbert?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know we talked on the phone briefly, but your name is not a household name, although after tonight we're going to make that change a little bit. Tell us about yourself, Herbert.
Well, I have a degree in electrical engineering, and it's kind of funny because I went to junior college I graduated from junior college in 1967, and I was out of school for quite a while before I went back in 1979 to do my upper division work. I was working at jobs and things.
Sure.
So I was out of school for a while, and I had... just before I went back to University of California to do upper division work, I happened to be traveling on the East Coast, and I stopped in at Virginia Beach, where the Edgar Casey Library is. The ARE, Edgar Casey Library.
Association of Research and Enlightenment. That must have been quite a destination stop for you. I know I
loved
it there.
Yes, I knew a lot about it. And when I was in there... I brought an interesting book. It was by an author that was using a false name, Rho Sigma. And Rho Sigma wrote a book, was called Ether Technology.
Huh.
And a subtitle, A Rational Approach to Gravity Control. So I figured, well, that looks interesting. I think I'll buy it. So I did, and I studied it. And inside, I found out all about Thomas Townsend Brown, who had invented a way to electrically create artificial gravity, and he patented his inventions and called gravitators, and so he does have patents on them. And this was all done in the 1920s. And I said, my God, this stuff should be taught in all the science classes and at the university.
Indeed.
And then later I went to the university, and I realize, hey, they're not even talking about this stuff. They're still teaching us that Einstein said there's no connection between electricity and gravity. And I knew damn well that that wasn't true. Uh-huh. And so I began to realize, you know, there's a lot of holes in what they're teaching us in the curriculum at the university. And in class one time, I was told by one professor that longitudinal electromagnetic waves are mathematically proven to be impossible. And at that statement, I raised my hand, and the teacher pointed towards me. And I said, well, you know, Nikola Tesla was using spherical antennas to transmit electrical power wirelessly. Uh-huh. And those kind of antennas can only transmit longitudinal waves. And he got a real disgusted look on his face and waved at me, and he kind of waved me aside and said, I don't want to discuss Nikola Tesla.
Really? What an enlightened man he is. What campus were you at, Herbert? Which campus?
This was University of California at Santa Barbara.
Oh, my God. That's where I went, Herbert. That's where I went.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, cool. So you probably are familiar with the area then.
I lived there 9 years on Del Playa, on the ocean, on the beach.
Well, this was like a big awakening to me. I thought universities were supposed to be the place for the free interchange of ideas.
Absolutely.
And then I realized that, no, they're there to promote programs that corporations decide upon the programs they're going to teach there, and they're not going to have much leeway in those programs. And that's when I became kind of disillusioned with the university.
Did you, Herbert, this is fascinating. I have a question. Did you sense at that time that this was a conspiracy of foreknowledge or a conspiracy of kind of multiple ignorance issues that were involved?
At the time, I just thought that they were trying to push through their particular programs, and they didn't want to look outside the areas that they were teaching us.
Right.
I didn't really think about a conspiracy at that time.
Okay.
But I did later. I graduated in 1982 from UCSB.
Uh-huh.
With a degree, a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. And about 3 years after that, in 1985, I read a book by Thomas Bearden and another one by John Bendini. And they were both telling us that free energy was possible, and they had already invented a free energy machine.
Yes, John, I know. Bendini, I know. Tom was on the program here years ago. Wonderful mind. John Bendini has been on a number of times. Mm-hmm. Both brilliant men, extraordinary men. Yes, indeed.
That's right. And so at that time, I decided I was going to become a free energy researcher. That sort of fascinated me, the whole subject. And I studied a lot of books by a lot of different authors. One of my favorite sources of info at that time was an outfit known as Rex Research. They had all kind of folios.
I remember them. I remember. Yeah.
And I studied all the stuff over, and I said, my God, you know, there's so much stuff they don't tell us about in college at all. You know, there's just big holes in their course material. And then later in 1993, I went to a International Tesla Symposium that was held in Colorado Springs. And I got to see my first working free energy machine. It was by a fellow named Jonathan Newman, or Joseph Newman. And he called it his energy machine. And there was a lot of engineers present at this demonstration, and he invited us to come up and check out the circuit, the wiring and everything, which we did. We had our meters, voltmeters, to check. It did work on batteries. It had batteries supplying energy to it, but the interesting thing is that the batteries were, he said, at 500 volts, these are a bunch of AA batteries all connected in series, so there's a lot of them. He said, at 500 volts, they're discharged, and I'm going to run this thing for a half an hour, which he did, and it was pumping water. He had it attached to a water pump. So it was pumping water for a half an hour, and we went back and checked the battery voltage after half an hour, and the voltage had gone up to 700 volts.
Oh.
So it was doing Yeah. It was doing work and charging the battery at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one really strange thing is these were Rayovac batteries, which are not supposed to be rechargeable.
Correct.
So that was one thing he pointed out, and he wanted to get a hold of Rayovac company and try to make a deal with them. I don't think that ever panned out. But anyway, he informed us that he had to sue the patent office for 10 years before he could actually get a patent on his machine. They kept turning it down, even though he had engineers test it, independent testing done that proved that it worked as he claimed. You know, they just used every excuse to avoid giving him a patent. So he sued him, and after 10 years,
most people
go bankrupt in that time. He finally won, and he got a patent on his energy machine.
He actually had to prosecute that case for 10 years to get a patent.
10 years, that's right.
Incredible.
So then I began to realize, hey, there's some kind of a force out there that is trying to suppress this stuff. And then I began to start suspecting a conspiracy. But I really became convinced in Ventura, California, in around 1985, there was a fellow that moved there. His name was Dennis Lee. He was the CEO of a heat pump factory up in Seattle. And during the time that Carter was president, Carter had a tax credit for anybody that would come up with a more efficient energy machine.
Uh-huh.
So he was making heat pumps, and he told his engineers, hey, let's try to make a better one here and qualify for this tax credit. So they started out with a heat pump that would probably pump about four times as much heat energy as electrical energy that it took to run the compressors. And they called that a COP of four, a coefficient of performance of four.
Right.
So his engineers went to work on this, and within about a year, they had come up with one that had a COP of 12, which is three times greater than the best ones around.
Huh.
So he qualified for the energy tax relief and got it and started manufacturing these super efficient heat pumps.
Uh-huh.
And they were selling like hotcakes up in Seattle. But the energy companies, they liked heat pumps because they would save electricity, but his heat pumps were saving too much electricity. And so the utility companies got together with the Attorney General of the state of Washington, and they sued him. He sued his company. And he had to shut his whole company down. He decided he'd move to Ventura, where he thought things would be better. Okay, so
little
anyway.
Little did he know, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so he got down there to Ventura, which is my stomping grounds. And in the meantime, he asked his engineers, he said, look, if we can get 12 times as much heat pumped as electrical energy that goes into it, couldn't we feed that heat into a heat engine, like a steam engine or some other kind of heat engine?
Yeah.
And tie it to an electrical generator and get more electricity out than we started with. And his engineer said, well, there's this problem of the Carnot efficiency, and tried to give all these reasons why it probably wouldn't work. But one engineer said, wait a minute. I know the Carnot efficiency is only about 30% in a heat engine, but if we use a new one that's been invented by a guy named Fisher, who's down in Australia, he claims that his heat engine is 90% efficient. It uses a totally different cycle. And so they got together with Fisher, and they joined their inventive sources and came out with their super efficient heat pump tied to a Fisher cycle heat engine. And sure enough, they were getting three times more electricity out of the thing than they were putting into it.
Wow.
Which is okay. And at the same time,
yeah.
It was cooling the air down. So it would take the heat energy out of the air and turn it into electricity. And so he gave a demonstration in Oxnard, California, in a big auditorium down there.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was in 1985. It could have been six. I'm not exactly sure of the date. But it made the newspapers. Members of the press were there. A lot of engineers were there. He had it all, his whole machine up on a stage, and he had this bank of 10 rows by 10 in a column of 100-watt light bulbs, and he said, this load represents 10 kilowatts.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm going to start the machine up using the electrical power of the auditorium. He had an extension cord he plugged into it. He says, after it gets going, I can pull the plug and the machine will still keep going. It's making its own electricity now. And he invited engineers and different people to go up and check the wiring, make sure there was no hidden wires or anything. They did. And then he started up the machine and it started going, and then he pulled the plug and threw it off to the side, and the machine was still going. And then he said, now I'm going to apply the load. And when he threw this big switch, and 10 kilowatts worth of light bulbs all lit up. And everybody was kind of awed by this. And then he said, now this is not free energy, he said. What we're doing is we're extracting the heat energy out of the air around us. And so we're generating 10 kilowatts of electricity here. And at the same time, we're cooling the whole auditorium down. So what we have here is a free energy machine plus an air conditioning.
Air conditioning. Amazing. This is a stunning night for you. Wow.
Oh, so anyway, what happened within 2 days after he gave that demonstration, the Ventura County Sheriff's Department had a big semi-truck and trailer. They backed it up to his laboratories. They arrested Dennis Lee. They confiscated all of the equipment out of his laboratory. Plus, he had a lot of engineers and physicists working there. And they confiscated all the proprietary research papers they had on all his business contracts. They confiscated the whole thing. And they put Dennis Lee in jail for a year. He went for a year without any trial at all. His company went bankrupt. And then after it went bankrupt, they released him and dropped all the charges.
Oh, but it can't possibly be, Herbert. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Isn't that what this country is all about? How could they jail a genius like that? Listen, that decision obviously came down from a very dark and high location.
Exactly.
The lesson there. And Dennis Lee may have been lucky. There are, as you know, a lot of people who are dead because of their genius.
Right. Well, he finally, after he got out of jail, he sued the Ventura County Sheriff's Department to get all his confiscated property back. And they told him, no, we're keeping it for evidence. He never got any of it back.
Wow.
So that's the story of Dennis Lee.
Well, Dennis got his life back. I mean, they could have hung him in his jail cell.
He kept trying. He tried other ventures, but none of them got off the ground after that.
Well, go ahead.
I can tell you a dozen similar stories that I found out about after I started researching the business. Another famous guy was Edwin Gray, who came out with, he started up a company called Ev Gray Motor Company.
Uh-huh.
He developed an electric car that could go 700 miles on a charge in just two standard car, 12-volt car batteries.
Two batteries, 700 miles?
He had a 700-mile range with just two 12-volt lead-acid batteries. And he actually won an award from Reagan when Reagan was governor of California. He got a certificate of merit from the governor.
Yeah, but he represented a mortal threat to the automobile industry and the petroleum industry and all the accessory industries that feed those two. You can't do that, folks, and this is what happens. You ask, is there such a thing as what we call free energy, more efficient energy? Are there other means and modalities of gaining it, like pulling energy from the heat around us? Absolutely.
Right.
There's probably a warehouse full of concepts and ideas, a small warehouse at least. And again,
so,
I point out that
a
lot of these people end up dead, Herbert, and I'm glad that Dennis at least survived.
What happened to Edwin Gray, his motor company was, there was a lot of excitement about it, and a lot of investors were lining up to invest in it.
Oh, sure.
And suddenly he had a big lawsuit against the corporation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it shut down the whole operation.
You know, Herbert, this goes all the way back. I mean, it goes way back, but I mean, one of the most early examples of this kind of government destruction was what happened to Royal Raymond Rife.
That's right.
As you
That's
well
right.
know.
I'm very familiar with that.
Yes, yes.
I kind of like to cover, this is basically covered in my third book, but I'd like to go back to my first book.
Yes, yes. Now, you have a number of books out. There's Herbert Dorsey and there's Herbert G. Dorsey on Amazon. Are we all the same Herbert here, or is there another Herbert Dorsey?
Well, I am Herbert Grove Dorsey III for my total official title.
Well, that's you. All right, we have coefficients of linear expansion at low temperatures, the secret space program, and then we fast forward from that, and you've updated the secret space program. Go ahead.
Yeah. I have to tell you that, you know, I gave you a link that goes to Amazon site showing all my books, but unfortunately they also show my grandfather's books and my father's or some of his books. My grandfather, he was a PhD in physics, and he taught at the National Bureau of Standards. He was a professor there. Oh. And plus he invented quite a bit of stuff himself. My father was an Antarctic explorer. He went to Antarctica with Adelbert's second expedition in 1939.
Oh, this is fascinating. That now 1939, that's the same time the Germans went down there in 1938-39.
Yep. Yep, that's right.
We just did a program on that recently here. For a friend of mine is going down there. Yeah.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is briefly go over my first book, which, or actually my second book, which is The Secret History of the New World Order.
Right.
Because there's a lot, number of important points that I would like to point out. I start out with the history of Christianity, which kind of turned off some people, you know. They didn't want to know all about how Christianity evolved. But I showed how much it was changed from the original teachings of Christ to what later became the Catholic Church.
How did you ever, Herbert, excuse me, this is a wonderful topic. We could spend a whole program on this. How did you find the research avenues to pursue to come up with data to construct a book to explain this? Because it's one of the great cover-ups in history.
Well, I listed a lot of the sources in my bibliography in the back of the book.
All right.
I do read a lot.
Told me that when we talked, and obviously you are a machine. You read all the time. Fascinating.
Yep.
And that's how you learn.
I can do two or three books a day. I mean, two or three books
you told
a week.
Me that. You told me that. You're two or three books a week, and you've got a thirst. Have you always felt this way about knowledge and seeking it?
Well, I'm a Gemini, which has a great deal of curiosity.
Uh-huh.
And if anybody has a secret, I'm really curious to find out what the hell they keep in secret and why. You know?
What so a brilliant way secret, to go about life. That's fascinating. What a
anything
great motive.
That's secret, I am really fascinated with, and I want to dig until I find out what it is. So things like the CIA or secret societies, things like that, I really dig into as much
okay.
as I can.
Okay. Now, hold on. We have to take a little short break. We will come right back, Herbert, in just a couple minutes, so don't go anywhere. The Secret History of the New World Order. What I'm going to do is link to that book and several others so you can go straight there and get these books. And I think you can tell that this is an extraordinary mind, a human being who has really gone looking behind the curtain. Stand by, and we'll be back with Herbert Dorsey. Okay, welcome back. Talking with Herbert Dorsey, and you go to Amazon, and he is a prolific writer and thinker, and there, I don't know how many books altogether you've written, Herbert, but The Secret History of the Five of the New World Order, Secret Science and the Secret Space Program, CIA, Crime Incorporated of America, and The Covert Colonization of Our Solar System, the most recent book. Which one did I miss?
The Adventurer, that's my autobiography. That was my first book.
Uh-huh.
It was written for friends and family. I don't really expect the public to be that interested.
Listen, I think there are a lot of folks listening who would like to read that story. I would. Go ahead, please. The Secret History of the New World Order, which I hasten to add to anyone listening, in case you're not up to speed on this, is not only a fait accompli, it's worse than that. We are in the hands of very, very dark evil right now, and it's becoming very obvious. Go ahead, Herbert, please. This is a great conversation.
Well, don't everybody get totally bummed out. There's also a lot of good forces that are trying to counter this evil.
That's the other side of the coin. Let's talk about it.
Maybe you're one of them, huh?
Well, I've been doing something for 24 years. I don't know what.
I mean, you're one of the best. In my opinion, anyway, you have one of the best alternative news sites on the web.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
okay.
Herbert.
But anyway, getting back to the secret history of the New World Order, there's two really important, or probably more than that, but really important things I'd like to talk about. And the first one is that, it's really important by what's going on in the Middle East right now. The Catholic Church created the religion of Islam. And it's in my book. And
that's fascinating. Now, just let me pop this in. The Pope is welcoming one of the biggest, most powerful Muslims on the planet to the Vatican. That's just been announced yesterday.
Well, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. At the time of Muhammad, the Roman Empire was in a state of collapse. A lot of the foreign legions were pulled out of the colonies of the Roman Empire and pulled back to Rome to defend Rome from the barbarians that were starting to attack Rome. And by this time, the Catholic religion was the official religion of Rome. And the Vatican, or the priests that were at St. Peter's Basilica, I don't know if it was called the Vatican that early in history, but anyway, they were quite concerned about losing the holy city of Jerusalem. They had built their Church of the Holy Sepulchre there. There was a lot of connections between their religion and Jerusalem, so they really prized Jerusalem, and they were afraid of losing it. So they came up with this plan, and the plan was they already had Augustine or Augustinian missions in Arabia. They already had a number of Catholic missions in Arabia. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that Muhammad's first wife was a widow. Her first husband died, and she was a Catholic, and when she died, she committed herself to a convent and one of the Augustinian missions, and she was there for a while, and suddenly the priest told her that they had a mission for her. They wanted her to go back in the world, and they wanted her to marry Muhammad. And so she did go back into the world, and she hired Muhammad. Her first husband was a wealthy merchant, so she gave a lot to the church, but she still had some left. She hired Muhammad to do a caravan to Syria, and his caravan was quite successful, and he was a fairly honest man. He is highly regarded among his peers there for mm-hmm. being a good businessman. So he had a successful caravan, and when he came back, she let him know that she would like to marry him. And she was about 40, and he was in his early 20s at the time, but she was a good looking gal even though she was in her 40s, and so he decided to marry her. Mm-hmm. And so she became like a sugar mama to Muhammad. And he started having a lot of free time on his hands, and he started hanging out in these caves in nearby mountains.
An idle mind is the desert's playground, remember. The devil.
Well,
anyway.
he claimed that he saw these visions that the Archangel Gabriel came and spoke with him in these while he was in these caves. And at their household, there was also the cousin of his wife, a fellow named Waranka.
Okay.
And Waranka was also a very staunch Catholic. So these two people started helping Muhammad interpret what Gabriel was telling him. And these interpretations turned into the Quran. But But you have to realize that they were basically acting on orders from the Augustinian order while they were interpreting the Quran.
Now, this is Herbert. Let me recap. The Catholic Church, folks, and we hear so much about the Muslim invasion of Europe now and this country. It's underway here. The Catholic Church is behind the creation of Islam. You got to remember that. Okay, this is key. This didn't come down from some angelic source. This was a creation. This is very fascinating and extremely important, and obviously heretical, and could get people in trouble in certain parts of the world. Now, this was going on with Muhammad out in the desert. What city? What area?
Right, in Medina. He was in Medina. Okay. So then later Muhammad was approached by members of the Augustinian order, and they said, look, you're going to need an army to spread your religion, and we will finance your army. We'll help you finance it.
Wow.
And the deal we want to make with you is your army will keep getting stronger and stronger until you control Arabia, and then we want you to invade Judea. And when you invade Judea, we wish you to turn over the city of Jerusalem to us. Now, see, at this time, the Roman Empire still owned Jerusalem, but they were rapidly losing control, and there was a big fear that the Jewish people would regain control of Jerusalem when they had to withdraw their troops. So this was a crisis kind of decision they made during a time of crisis, and it was a plan that they would create this new religion because they had already tried to convert the people in Saudi Arabia to Christianity, but they realized that most of them wouldn't accept it, so they had to create a new religion that would be more acceptable to them. So that was the reason why they created the Muslim religion.
Huh.
And the idea was that they were going to use these Muslims to gain control of Jerusalem and sort of use their soldiers to guard it for the Vatican, so they would still have control.
But Herbert, where did all from what we hear, the hideously evil, subhuman behaviors of the religion, so-called religion, I call it a death cult, where did they come from?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of other stories here, too. You have to realize this was sort of done under a stress of, you know, they had to do something drastic. They probably wouldn't have done it under normal situation, you know, but they were afraid of losing Jerusalem, so this was their strategy. Well, this all went well as long as Muhammad was alive. He pretty well stuck with his agreements with him and everything. But the problem was, before they actually invaded Judea, he died, and he was replaced by a guy named Kobar.
Yeah.
And he was the new caliphate of the Islam religion.
So he took the whole religion basically into his control,
basically after the death of Muhammad. And they finally were able to invade Jerusalem and take it over. And then the Catholic Church said, well, we'd like you to turn it over to us now. And the new leader said, nope, it's a holy spot for us. We're going to keep it. And we don't need your help anymore. We're powerful enough. We don't need the Vatican's help anymore. So basically, it was the guy who replaced Muhammad that reneged on the deal. And so then there was a lot of really disastrous blowback because these Muslims kept getting stronger and they controlled all of North Africa, and then they started to invade Spain, which was a Catholic country, and they just about took over all of Spain for a while. And they were, you know, they were starting to threaten
Catholic kingdoms. That's right. They moved all the way up into Spain and threatened Europe.
So this was like blowback from their original plan. And, you know, it was the unintended consequences, you might say. Well, now, we're getting, in more modern times, there was another important area that was known as the Reformation.
Yeah. Herbert, would you hold that thought? I'm sorry, there's so much here, as you know. Your mind is like a library on steroids. When you go into the idea of Islam being a religion, the origins of it, again, came from this woman and her cousin, I think you said, was it? Her cousin or her brother?
They helped Muhammad interpret what the visions that he had of Gabriel. Basically, that's what they did.
Okay. So they obviously wield a great deal of influence in that, and they could have shaped them in any way, many ways.
Well, a wife usually does, especially if it's an older wife.
Yeah.
She was old enough to be his mother.
Oh, that's
almost.
The point. Exactly. This is a kid, and she's telling him what he's being told. She's interpreting it. And this is all, again, at the behest of the Catholic Church.
Right. She was acting on orders from the Catholic Church.
Wow.
Okay, so, and there is a clue in the Quran. I've read the Quran, and they do worship the Virgin Mary in the Quran. And the Virgin Mary is a distinctly Catholic invention. So that's one little clue right there in the Quran, that it was had the Catholic influence.
Is there any reference to this woman or the situation between she and Muhammad anywhere, or is this kind of a real dark and dusty secret that nobody knows about?
Okay, now there's this man named Adolfo Riviera. Now, Adolfo Riviera was a Jesuit of the Fourth Oath, which means he was right up there in the top. But he was a Jesuit with a conscience. And at the time, he was being, his mentor was another Jesuit priest. He was the confessor to Pope Pius XII. I'm trying to remember his name. I can't. Yeah, my memory isn't perfect. Anyway, he took Adolfo Riviera down to the Vatican Library and showed him the documents about this creation of Islam on the part of the Catholic Church. It's documented, and the documents are hidden in the Vatican Library.
Uh-huh.
Adolfo Riviera got to see the documents, and he was told how his name was Bia, B-E-A, and he was the Jesuit confessor to Pope Pius XII.
Huh.
Bia was his mentor and told him this whole story that I've just related to you.
Right.
And later, Adolfo Riviera quit the Catholic or the Jesuit order, and he became a born again Christian.
Huh.
And so he started revealing all the secrets that the Jesuits were planning, and a lot of his tracts were at a place called Chick Publications. If you go to Chick Publications, I mentioned this in the book. I show you where I got the information. I got it from Adolfo Riviera, basically.
Hmm.
And he has one book there at Chick Publications. It's under the Adolfo Riviera section of their books, and it's called The Prophet. And in that one, it tells the story of how the Muslim religion was created. So anyway, for people who are curious...
Well, this is all extremely important for a number of reasons for anyone who cares about what's going on. When you watch the invasion of Europe and what's going on here in this country by Muslims, and you look at the pictures and you see that the majority of them are, let's call them, fighting age males. There are very few females and children. What goes through your mind, Herbert?
Well, I have a lot of sympathy for the refugees because they were created by U.S. foreign policy.
Yes.
We're directly responsible for, destroying Iraq, destroying Syria, trying to destroy Syria, and destroying Libya.
Correct.
And also Afghanistan.
That's irrefutable.
A place where
Understood.
A lot of these refugees are coming from.
Yeah.
If the U.S. had been a peaceful country in the last decade, or last decade and a half, there wouldn't be this big refugee problem right now that's coming to Europe. We're the ones who caused that problem.
Do you find that we may have, in fact, orchestrated at some level this mass influx of fighting-age men? And they do come from Black Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa. They come from Syria. They come from Afghanistan. They come from all over the Middle East as well. This
right.
is not just one group from Syria. They're not just Syrian refugees, as you're pointing out. I'm very concerned that these people do have an allegiance, an alliance with Daesh, ISIS, and that there are prepositioned weapons and there are weapons being shipped into Europe, and we very well might see armed warfare in Europe from these people. Once you get to the 5% occupancy rate, as it were, in a country of a foreign group like this, you don't get rid of them. You have to deal with it somehow, sometime, some way. And the violence in Islam is rather historic. I don't know where you think it came from or how it was added, but maybe the successor to Muhammad was the one who integrated this. I don't know, but it got in there.
No. It's more recent than that.
It's more recent.
I have to say a few things about this.
Please.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have to understand, there's another book I'm going to recommend. It's not my book. It's written by a guy named David Livingston.
Okay.
And it's called Terrorism and the Illuminati.
Right.
And he points out that a lot of these terrorists are actually created by intelligence agencies.
Yes.
CIA, MI6 from England, and Mossad.
Correct.
And
absolutely.
I have to say that the Wahhabi religious movement is really a curse on Islam. There's, you know, Islam itself isn't that bad of a religion because it teaches people to be submissive to Allah and behave themselves and to be fair to each other. The actual religion isn't that evil. But then we get these fundamentalist kind of religions like Wahhabism that say, okay, you can't have any statues or any kind of
no idols.
You can't have any figures or idols, and all that stuff is wrong. And in the punishment, we can cut your head off, or we can give you 1,000 lashings with a cane, all this kind of very cruel and unusual punishment.
It's inhuman,
The Wahhabis were actually created by British intelligence. Would you believe that one?
I always thought of it as a Zionist. They had their hands in there, too. We'll go with the British intelligence. Sure, whatever.
Okay, now you see, during the late 1800s, England wanted to take control of Arabia. But it was part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire.
Right.
So their strategy was they sent this fellow in there, and he contacted a guy named Abdul Wahhab, and he paid Abdul Wahhab to create this Wahhabi religion. And the basic thing was the religion was accusing all the regular Muslims of being apostate because they had idols, or they were worshiping idols, or they were doing this or that or whatever. But they turned out that you got to read David Livingston's book, Terrorism and the Illuminati.
Okay.
Because then it shows just how terrible and how anti Islamic the Wahhabi movement was. They actually started raiding holy sites. They went into Mecca. They started just killing all the people in Mecca. And this was a major Muslim holy site, the Wahhabis.
What years were these approximately?
These were like in the 1800s, middle to late 1800s.
All right, a couple hundred years ago, right?
Yeah, the documentation, I don't have it all but in my books, but it is
You mentioned Wahhabis.
David Livingston's book.
Mr. Livingston would certainly be one of the first to point out in his book that the Wahhabis are, in fact, the kingdom of the Sauds.
I'll tell you how that worked out. Yeah. They got this Wahhabi religion going, and finally the Mr. Wahhab said he was the true leader of Islam, and he declared a jihad against the Ottoman Sultan. Okay, so that's what the British wanted to happen. So suddenly these Wahhabis are fighting the normal Islamic people and making war on them and everything.
Uh-huh.
And they attacked Karbala, they attacked Mecca, all these very holy sites of the Muslim religion. They attacked them, they destroyed the temples, they desecrated them, killed the people. They did all kind of horrible stuff. And so finally the Sultan of the Ottoman Sultan said, well, he got together with the King of Egypt, says, hey, you got to do something about these Wahhabis. So they sent a big army in, and they defeated them all. But the problem was they were survivors, and they hung out in Rijah in Saudi Arabia, and they started expanding again.
In Riyadh, what we all...
Riyadh.
Yeah.
Yeah, Riyadh, I'm sorry. I'm not the Pope, and I'm not infallible.
Oh, no, listen, but let me do... all right, we have about 3 minutes left, Herbert. Would you be able to come back tomorrow night for an hour and finish this up and cover more areas? There's so many things we could talk about. If you're available, I'd love to have you come back tomorrow night, if that's possible. We'll talk.
If you read my books, you'll find out all about it.
Yeah, I understand. Well, you've got so many fascinating subjects. Here's the story I wanted to tell you about. This is out of the Vatican, May 19th, an official meeting between Pope Francis and Imam Ahmed al-Tayeb, T-A-Y-Y-E-B, will take place Monday at the Vatican, signaling a new step in Catholic-Muslim relations. An audience between the Pope and the great Imam of Al-Azhar is being prepared for Monday, said the Vatican spokesman. Now, this is unprecedented. This is scheduled again for yesterday. It happened yesterday. So just to give you that note.
Okay, now I'll comment on that. Adolfo Rivière said that the highest imams, like the highest Catholic priests, know that the Islam was created by the Catholics. The present-day imams know that.
Yeah.
But they don't want to reveal it to their people because it will cause big tidal waves of political repercussions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay? So, you know, this is common knowledge among the higher-ups, but it's the regular people that don't know about it.
Man, if they knew they weren't going to get their 72 virgins, there wouldn't be so many martyrs, would there?
Well, perhaps. Perhaps. But I'll say one more thing. These intelligence agencies are all created by the Illuminati.
Yeah.
And the Illuminati was created by the Jesuits, and they're still controlled by the Jesuits. So on back of it all, we have these Jesuits that created Zionism. They took over Freemasonry, and they control Freemasonry globally now. And all the prime ministers of Israel happen to be high-level Freemasons.
Right.
So, and a lot of our presidents, of course, have also been high-level Freemasons. So this is how they exert their control, through these secret societies.
So the Jesuit Black Pope and all of that, they really are the movers and shakers in the shadows. That's what you're saying.
Yes, that's right. That's who is the leaders of the New World Order.
Wow. Wow.
It all comes out of the Vatican. Since 1814, the Vatican has been controlled by the Jesuits.
Okay.
That's when they were reinstated. You know, they were outlawed in 1773 because of all the horrible stuff they were doing in Europe.
Yeah, there was a lot of bad. Let me read the books that Herbert Dorsey has written. The Secret History of the New World Order, which we've been briefly talking about. Secret Science and the Secret Space Program. CIA, Crime Incorporated of America, CIA. And The Covert Colonization of Our Solar System. And his biography called The Adventurer. And with that, I thank you, Herbert, very much. And if you would like to come back for an hour tomorrow night to do just a part two on this, I'd love to talk about this.
Let me check with my boss and see if I can swing this.
Wonderful. All right. Let me know, or I'll check with you tomorrow. We can talk about the secret space program. I think that would be fascinating if we can. Thank you very much, Herbert. Oh, I think he's checking right now. Let's wait. I hear noise in the background. This is a fascinating wellspring of knowledge.
You know, my other half is my boss, so I
have to
check with her. Yes, I can do it tomorrow night.
Well, tell her thank you, and we will talk to you. In fact, at this very hour, we'll start 1 hour later than we did tonight. So it'll be 8 o'clock tomorrow night instead of 7 Pacific time, and we'll talk about the secret space program.
Hold on. Is there any chance we could just do it at the same time, or is that impossible?
Well, let me take a look. I think we can. I'm not sure, but let me see if I can, and I'll get back to you.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Herbert.
You're welcome.
All right. Very good. Okay. That's hour one, and we'll pause and come back. It's sometimes very difficult to shift things around, but I'll see what I can do. Okay. There's a man who knows on which side the toast gets buttered, as they say. Check with his better half. Okay, back in a few minutes. Hold on.